Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now covering Deuteronomy 20, verses 1 through 20, the entire chapter. This chapter concerns laws having to do with warfare. Our context is this. In the previous chapter, Deuteronomy 19, we looked at the six cities of refuge to which manslayers who have accidentally or negligently killed someone could flee to escape the kinsman blood avenger of the deceased. And then we looked at laws concerning witnesses in the court system. And now we will look at laws concerning warfare. So we start with Deuteronomy 20, verses 1 through 4. When you go out to battle, again, this is God speaking to Moses, and Moses speaking to the people on the plains of Moab. This is the second of three discourses to the people on the plains of Moab. When you go out to, and the first discourse had to do with stay away from idolatry. The second discourse had to do with what the law was and how you should obey the law, Israelites. So, verse 1, when you go out to battle against your enemies and see horses and chariots and people more numerous than you, do not be afraid of them, for the Lord your God, who brought you up from the land of Egypt, is with you. When you are approaching the battle, the priest shall come near and speak to the people. He shall say to them, "Hear, O Israel, you are approaching the battle against your enemies today. Do not be faint-hearted, do not be afraid, or panic, or tremble before them. For the Lord your God is the one who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies, to save you." Now, these verses and the rest of the chapter refer to battles the Israelites would be involved in, and we can categorize these battles in two ways. First, the way John Gill does it is those battles that are commanded by the Lord and those that are permitted by the Lord. The second way you can categorize the battles is by those battles that are carried on against cities outside the land of Canaan and those within the land of Canaan. So let's start with the first distinction, battles that are commanded by the Lord and those that are permitted by the Lord. Now, I have a direct conflict of my authorities here. Adam Clark says that these rules that are listed here in verses in this chapter cannot be considered to apply to any wars which they might have with the surrounding nations for political reasons, as the divine assistance could not be expected in wars which were not undertaken by the divine command. In other words, they were political wars that were not Yahweh wars, not wars commanded by Yahweh, and so these rules wouldn't apply there, and the Israelites should not expect assistance from God. Well, I find that extremely problematical. John Gill contradicts Clark. God bless him. He says this, quote, concerning wars, quote, "voluntary and arbitrary, which was left to their own discretion and will, as they saw fit when they were provoked or distressed or when invaded by their enemies, or they saw reason to go out against them and either act the offensive or defensive part or both." And I think, if I remember correctly, Gill is saying, look, just because God didn't directly command it, but if the leaders of Israel or the king of Israel saw an aggressive nation coming after them, they had every right to go after them without getting a direct command from God. And I think Gill is right about that. I think that these rules would not apply just to battles commanded by God. Now, the second distinction, wars that are fought outside of Canaan versus wars that are fought inside Canaan, we'll take up when we get to the next section here, next few verses. So let's continue with these verses here. Verse 1, when you go out to battle against your enemies and see horses and chariots, this is likely to frighten the Israelites because they didn't have horses and chariots. So that's like infantry going up against tanks, I guess. It's kind of frightening. Moses, or God through Moses, mentions that the Lord your God who brought you up from the land of Egypt, he's constantly mentioning the Exodus. Why? Because God did such miraculous things on the Exodus to preserve the people, and so that's meant to encourage them. Now notice in verse 2 that a priest speaks to the people. A priest encourages them. Don't be faint-hearted. Don't panic. God's with you. He's going to save you. He's going to fight for you against your enemies. Now, it doesn't say which priest. I assume it's just whichever priest the Israelites or the military commander, Joshua, felt like saying, here, go speak to the people. Doesn't really say. Now, priests sometimes accompanied the army, as we see in the famous incident of the siege of the Battle of Jericho, Joshua 6, verses 4 through 8. Also, seven priests shall carry seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. Then on the seventh day you shall march around the city, that's Jericho, seven times, and the priests shall blow the trumpets. It shall be when they make a long blast with the ram's horn, and when you hear the sound of the trumpet, all the people will shout with a great shout, and the wall of the city will fall down flat. And the people will go up, every man straight ahead. So Joshua the son of Nun called the priest and said to them, take up the Ark of the Covenant and let seven priests carry seven trumpets. Da-dot, 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 da-dot. The seven priests carrying the seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Lord went forward and blew the trumpets. So this was not just a secular war for land. This was a religious war. We go now to verses 5 through 9 of Deuteronomy 20. The officers also shall speak to the people, saying, who is the man that has built a new house and has not dedicated it? Let him depart and return to his house. Otherwise he might die in the battle, and another man would dedicate it. Who is the man that has planted a vineyard and has not begun to use its fruit? Let him depart and return to his house. Otherwise he might die in the battle, and another man would begin to use its fruit. And who is the man that is engaged to a woman and has not married her? Let him depart and return to his house. Otherwise, return to his house. Otherwise, he might die in the battle and another man would marry her. Then the officers shall speak further to the people and say, who is the man that is afraid and faint-hearted? Let him depart and return to his house, so that he might not make his brother's hearts melt like his heart. When the officers have finished speaking to the people, they shall appoint commanders of armies at the head of the people. Now, I'm assuming the officers here are military officers. It could be officers of the nation of Israel, political people. But I'm assuming it's military officers. I could be wrong. But isn't that a way to get your army ready to fight? The officers called the army. This, of course, reminds us of what Gideon did, remember? As the NIV Study Bible points out, exemptions from the military were often quite extensive, and there were a lot of exemptions here, and it just seems strange to me. You're trying to get ready to fight the Canaanites, who outnumber you, and here you are culling down your army pretty severely. Again, this is to show that the Israelites were not going to conquer the land of Israel with the arm of their flesh. It was going to be a supernatural victory. You remember the story of Gideon, of course. I won't read this to you, but just to refresh our memory, when Gideon said, whoever's afraid and trembling, leave. 22,000 people left, went back home, only leaving 10,000 behind. There's a culling. Now, of course, further culling was done. Who drinks the water with a head up? So they're on the alert. And at the end of the story, there's only 300 men left. So, as the NIV Study Bible says, the people were not to trust in the size of their army, but in the Lord. Jameson Fawcett Brown says these exemptions that are mentioned must have taken place before the troops mustered. It would have caused great confusion if done afterwards, and I think that's probably true. Now let's look at some of these exemptions. If a man has built a new house, go back to your new house. You've not dedicated it. There was a custom in Israel to dedicate a new house to God with prayer, praise, and thanksgiving, as Adam Clark says. Clark refers to the title of Psalm 30, which says this, a psalm or song at the dedication of the house of David. Well, I think that's the temple. I'm not sure that's a private dwelling. But anyway, I assume Clark's right when he says that no pious man thought he could live in a house that was not dedicated to God. And so the man says, that the officers say, you're going to be thinking about that house that you didn't dedicate. You might not be fighting. You might not take the risk that are necessary in battle, because soldiers who are afraid to take risk oftentimes endanger themselves and their fellow soldiers because it's necessary to take risk in battle. So he doesn't want somebody with his mind on his house at home. Likewise, the man who's planted a vineyard, he's just started his business. You don't want a man thinking about his finances when he's getting ready to go into battle because he might not take risk because he wants to go back and keep his business going. And of course, his wife, if he's just married somebody or gotten engaged to somebody, he says, oh, if I die, somebody else is going to marry. I want to go back to my sweetheart. That's the soldier that's not going to fight so good. It reminds me of a great Clark Gable movie about World War I fighter pilots, and Clark Gable was one of the dashing single bachelor pilots of one of these death traps that they call World War I fighter planes, the biplanes. He had the sash around his neck, and nobody could touch him. But then he fell in love. I forgot who the actress was, but he fell in love with her. And he was getting ready to shoot at a German opponent in the air, and he thought of his wife, or his girlfriend, I don't remember. And he hesitated. And as he hesitated, he got shot. And the end of the movie has Clark Gable spiraling to the ground to his death because he was thinking about his wife at home. Well, this is the mentality. People that have something at home to live for might not take the risks that are necessary in battle. And then, of course, in verse 8, not only people who aren't all in for the battle, there's people who are just chickens, cowards. Who's the man that is afraid and faint-hearted? Now, this kills me. In front of everybody else, you've got to admit, I'm chicken. I can't go fight in this war, so I'm going home. I suppose that shame kept a lot of people from taking this option in order to avoid fighting. I'd be honest with you, I would be tempted to do that because I am a coward. Military things scare the fire out of me. I've always admired soldiers, how they can just go into war. I remember I was teaching some soldiers at a night class at an Army base near where I live. And this was when the Iraq War was going on. And he talked about how he and his buddies just stood out there. And he said that you could watch the trace of bullets coming in, whizzing by your head. He says he got tired of that. But a lot of his friends just got off on it. Just loved to get up there and start shooting at each other like they want a video game. Well, I'll be honest with you. I'm not that sort of person. I don't know how people do that, but some people do. But at any rate, these people would have to confess their cowardice in front of all their fellow soldiers and then would have to get the advantage of the victories that these soldiers won while they're at home making love with their wife and plucking their vineyards. But the military officers were more interested in a fighting unit they could win. That's what they were interested in. Deuteronomy 20, verses 10 through 15, when you approach a city to fight against it, you shall offer it terms of peace. If it agrees to make peace with you and opens to you, then all the people who are found in it shall become your forced labor and shall serve you. However, if it does not make peace with you, but makes war against you, then you shall besiege it. When the Lord your God gives it into your hand, you shall strike all the men in it with the edge of the sword. Only the women and the children and the animals and all that is in the city, all its spoil, you shall take as booty for yourself. And you shall use the spoil of your enemies which the Lord your God has given you. Thus you shall do to all the cities that are very far from you. This is outside the land of Canaan. Which are not of the cities of these nations nearby. That's talking about the seven Canaanite nations that are nearby across the Jordan River. So here's that second distinction I was telling you about. So here's the deal in summary. You make one of these cities an offer. We're going to come besiege you, but if you don't want to fight us, just surrender now. The men will become slaves, and so will the women, and so will the children. We'll make you our slaves, and we won't burn your city down. Fair enough. But if you decide to fight us, and we beat you, then all the men will be killed, and the women and children will be slaves. And the booty, the cattle and the oxen and so forth, and the gold and silver, whatever else is in the city, will be booty for the soldiers. Now, those terms, as serious as they might be, typical in the ancient Near East, are different than the terms when the besieged city was in Canaan. I'm going to jump ahead a little bit and talk about that. The deal was, if you besiege the city in Canaan, according to one view, is there were no terms offered. The city had no choice but to fight, and when they lost, the men were killed, the women and children were killed. There was no slavery, there was no booty. All of it was either dedicated to the Lord or destroyed, and that was it. Another view says that if this city was besieged in Canaan, the city could be offered terms, and the terms would be similar to these terms for the cities outside of Canaan. The men and the women become slaves, and the city loses all of its wealth, animals and gold and silver, etc., to the Israelites. So there are our options. Now, let's go back. We're now talking about the cities that are far off. Verse 10, you shall offer that city a term of peace before you besiege it. Now, John Gill says, what were those terms? Probably a renunciation of idolatry, and you will become tributaries to us, and you will pay us tribute, kind of like an annual tax. Now, that's not mentioned in the text. That's just Gill's speculation. But what is mentioned in the text is that the people in the surrendering city become slaves, forced labor. Now, this was a fulfillment of Noah's curse on Canaan. Genesis 9:25 says, cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants he shall be to his brothers. I suppose all these Canaanites are also outside the land of Canaan proper. And so they become slaves if they lose their city. Now, this, of course, does not mean that God likes slavery any more than a modern city likes prostitution because they regulate it. I mean, they didn't have anything else to do. I mean, the rules of warfare were kind of set up in the ancient Near East, and Israelites were just fighting according to the rules. Now, some people say that the forced labor that the surrendering men of the city are to be subject to is not slavery. I don't agree with that, but that's what some people say. They say that these men would be on occasion be called out to public service to fight an enemy, to rebuild palaces or cities or walls, or sometimes they just served the Israelites by paying them tribute. For example, 2 Samuel 8:2, second part of the verse, and the Moabites became servants to David, bringing tribute. I don't know what commentator I got that from. I didn't write it down, but I will say this. I don't think so. It sounds like slavery to me. All the people who are found in it shall become your forced labor, NASB says, and shall serve you. Now notice in verse 13, when the city is besieged and conquered, you shall strike all the men in it. That does not refer to the boys. That's talking about grown men. The soldiers, in other words, the people that can fight. They are the ones that bore the punishment because they were the ones who had the authority to surrender at once, but they didn't do it. So you don't surrender? See, that's the thing. If the people, the men inside the city, know they're going to die, that's a great incentive to just to surrender and just don't do it. Don't give up. Don't fight. Just give up. Save a lot of bloodshed that way. But if they fight and lose, they're going to die. So there's your incentive. Now, the women and children being captured as slaves for a city that, well, in either case, if the city surrenders or if the city is beaten, either case, the women and children are taken as slaves and the soldiers get booty. The provision for women and children being slaves gives rise to something somewhat positive, according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Quote, by this means, a provision was made for a friendly and useful connection being established between the captors and the captives, and Israel, even though her conquest would prove a blessing to the nations. Well, I guess it's better to be a slave to a conquering Israelite than get burnt up in a city. Now, I mentioned these rules were only for nations outside of Israel. How do I know that? Because verse 15 says, thus you shall do to all the cities that are very far from you. Now, why is there a difference? We'll see here later in just a minute that cities inside Israel got much worse terms, inside Canaan, got much worse terms than those cities that were outside Canaan. Now, I speculate there's a difference because undestroyed cities in Canaan would eventually destroy Israel. God had to wipe them out if the Israelites, especially considering their tendency to idolatry, the Israelites are likely not going to survive unless the cities in Canaan are absolutely destroyed. Now, John Gill says that the distinction between the cities outside and inside of Israel is not because of where they are so much as because of whether the wars were commanded or not. So he says that these cities far from Canaan were also the optional wars not directed by God, and so therefore the terms were more lenient. But the seven nations that were in Israel, the terms were stricter there because those were directed by God, the so-called Yahweh wars, they were directed by God, and so they were to be totally destroyed. So now we go to Deuteronomy 20, verses 16 through 18, and we'll look at the rules for cities inside of Canaan. Only in the cities of these peoples that the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, you shall not leave alive anything that breathes. Well, there's the more severe terms. No slavery. You die. But you shall utterly destroy them, the Hittite and the Amorite, the Canaanite and the Perizzite, the Hivite and the Jebusite, as the Lord your God has commanded you, so that they may not teach you to do anything according to all their detestable things which they have done for their gods, so that you would sin against the Lord your God. And of course, that's the real reason for the wiping out of the ites, is because they were idolaters who hated God and they would destroy Israel. Now, God says don't leave alive anything that breathes. That would be men, women, children, animals, everything. And let's take the easy case. This is in the case of a city within Canaan that does not surrender. We'll look at that, a surrendering city's options in just a minute. But let's just say that this city has refused to surrender and they lose. I mean, they get wiped out. The whole city's destroyed. Now, why such severity? As John Gill says, it's because of the degree of the Canaanites' wickedness, their idolatry, their incest, their witchcraft, their soothsaying, their necromancy, their child sacrifice. They got what they deserved, basically. Now, atheists love to look at this verse and other verses like it and say, oh, God's a genocidalist. Israel committed genocide and God led Israel to commit genocide. Now, of course, what these atheist mockers do when they do this, when they say this, is they never seem to realize that the Canaanites were the ancient equivalent of Nazis and communists. I mean, I don't feel bad that Adolf Hitler got wiped out. I don't feel bad for all those people in the Nuremberg trials who got wiped out. I don't feel bad that Germany was bombed. Now, I realize that it raises questions about innocent people in Germany who weren't Nazis who got knocked out too, but I don't know what else you're going to do. If you're going to beat the enemy, warfare is hell, and sometimes there's collateral damage. Well, here, these Canaanites, they were burning their own children to idols. Come on. They were the moral equivalent of Pol Pot, who created the killing fields of Cambodia. They were the moral equivalent of Mao Zedong, who killed 38 million people in the Great Leap Forward in the late 1950s. People like that deserve to die. What these atheist critics also often fail to realize is that modern genocidalists do it for land and power. For example, when the Armenians had the Armenian genocide early 20th century, when the Armenian Christians were wiped out, that was for land, it was for power. In Rwanda, you had two tribes killing each other, wiping them out, that was for power. When the Pol Pot did it, for power, for land. Yahweh was doing it to purge the land from evil, because there would have been no human being left if these people who were so evil had been left to keep going. Now, some Christians point out that this was Yahweh's land. He's the owner of the world. He can do what he wants to do. And I tend to shy away from that type of argument because, it just doesn't sound as persuasive to me, but it is true. He can judge the way he wants to judge. And all these innocent women and children, now, come on, how innocent were they? How many of those women were religious prostitutes? How many of the boys had not been so steeped in the idolatry that they were going around encouraging others to do it? Let's go to the temple today. It all depends on your presuppositions. If you believe there's no God, well, then Israel committed genocide. But if you believe that there's a God of justice who demands punishment for evil, well, then you don't say it's genocide. You'd call it justice. It's ironic that atheists who have adopted these humanitarian gentle ethical codes don't realize that their ethical codes came from Christianity, which is the driving force behind Western civilization as mankind became less and less barbaric. All you got to do is read medieval history and notice how those kings were scared to death of what God was going to do to them when they did something untoward. And gradually, as time went on, especially as we get to the New Testament, we see a Christian ethic of love and peace and gentleness and forgiveness and tolerance. And so the atheists batten on to what the Christians have created and say, see there, this God is a terrible God. He judge people. Well, you can't take God's love, justice, and mercy, love and mercy and peace on the one hand without accepting the other side, which is the judgment of evil, because there's not going to be any love and mercy and peace unless there's judgment. That's why we have a court system. That's why we have cops. Because people will kill you. Because people are evil. If you don't believe in original sin, just watch the crime stories on Lifetime TV or in the press about people raping and killing and kidnapping one another. There has to be judgment on evil. Otherwise, there is no peace. There is no love. The Canaanites, my friends, got exactly what they deserved. Now, there's a debate whether these cities within Canaan had no option but just to be destroyed utterly, men, women, and children, and livestock. It could be that the cities that were destroyed, men, women, and children, and livestock, were the cities that didn't surrender. Some people argue that there's an implied option of surrender without fighting, in which case the men, women, and children would be slaves instead of being killed. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but I think it's reasonable. John Gill says in favor of this argument, how about the Gibeonites when Joshua entered the land? If we suppose that the Gibeonites didn't hear the proclamation of terms, and so that would explain why Joshua didn't destroy the city, because they didn't hear what the deal was. And John Gill also points out that many Canaanites were allowed to live amongst the Israelites, and so therefore it must be that being a proselyte to Judaism was one of the terms of peace. If you don't fight the battle, you can become a proselyte. You can serve. It's not a slave exactly, but it's somebody that's not a true citizen, but on the other hand is not killed. He's being rewarded because he surrendered. Well, that might be true, but John Gill also points out that if it is true, the Canaanite cities didn't comply with these terms of peace, because Joshua destroyed almost all of the cities he came into contact with. So we can see from history, from Joshua, that most of the cities, whether they were offered terms of peace or not, didn't take those terms of peace, and so therefore were destroyed. Now, this verse here in verse 16 says that the Israelites are not to leave alive anything that breathes. So we ask the question, did the Israelites believe they had to kill everything that breathed? Adam Clark says, no, he doesn't think so. Now, here's his argument. Now, of course, this argument backs up the idea that Israel could offer terms in Canaan and therefore would not necessarily have to kill everything that breathes. Now, of course, they would if the cities fought. They'd have to kill everything that breathes. But to argue that Israel could have offered terms to the cities in Canaan, this is what Clark says. Quote, the above reasoning will gain considerable strength provided we could translate Chai haharem takaremem, thou shalt utterly subdue. The NASB says, utterly destroy them. What does it mean to utterly subdue or utterly destroy the cities? Slaying them if they resist. We've already said that's not an issue. If they don't resist, if they fight, they're going to get wiped out and leave nothing alive that breathed. But there could be another situation. They don't fight, they surrender. Then they would be destroyed politically, not physically. In that case, they would be, as Clark says, as he continues, totally expelled from the land, or they would be reduced to a state of slavery in it, that they might no longer exist as a people. All right, continuing his quote, this certainly made them anathema as a nation, wholly destroying their political existence. See the verb there that says, you shall utterly destroy them. In Deuteronomy 20, verse 17, you shall utterly destroy them is not talking about physical destruction necessarily, but in the case of cities that surrender without fighting, it would refer to political destruction. Clark goes on to say, probably this was so understood by the Gibeonites, viz., that they must either be slain or utterly leave the land, which at last was certainly in their power. And therefore, by stratagem, they got the princes of Israel to make a league with them. When the deceit was discovered, the Israelites, though not bound by their oath because they were deceived, yet though they had this command before their eyes, did not believe they were bound to put even those deceivers to death. But they destroyed their political existence by making them hewers of wood and drawers of water to the congregation, i.e. slaves. So that's one example of a city that was not destroyed, Gibeon. And then also Rahab was spared. So Clark continues, it does not appear that the Israelites believed that they were bound to put every Canaanite to death. Their political existence was under the anathema, and this the Hebrews annihilated. Clark goes on with his proof. Many of the Canaanites continued in the land even to the days of Solomon. That is to show that that is true. We have the fullest proof. For we read in 2 Chronicles 8:7, all the people of the land that were left of the Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites who were left in the land, whom the children of Israel consumed not, them did Solomon make to pay tribute to this day. Well, thus Solomon destroyed their political existence. But he did not consider himself bound by the law of God to put them to death. Well, that doesn't mean that doesn't prove anything to me. It means Solomon disobeyed the law. I mean, the hero of 1,000 wives and concubines, just because he didn't put them to death doesn't mean the law didn't mean for them to be put to death. So anyway, I think that's somewhat of a tenuous argument. Just because there were people not utterly put to death in Canaan, that does not mean that these cities were offered terms of peace. It could mean that they were not supposed to be offered terms of peace, but the Israelites did it anyway, against God's desires. Well, I leave that question open. As we turn now to Deuteronomy 20, verses 19 and 20, we'll finish this chapter. When you besiege a city a long time, God continues speaking through Moses to the people, when you besiege a city a long time to make war against it in order to capture it, you shall not destroy its trees by swinging an axe against them. For you may eat from them, and you shall not cut them down. For is the tree of the field a man, that it should be besieged by you? Only the trees which you know are not fruit trees you shall destroy and cut down, that you may construct siege works against the city that is making war with you until it falls. Now, this is a practical provision. You knock the fruit trees down, you capture the city, but then you can't live in the city because there's nothing to eat, because fruit trees take a long time to bear fruit, 2-3 years. The NIV Study Bible says the failure of later armies to obey this law caused Palestine to be stripped of trees. Adam Clark says destroying fruit trees would have been, quote, unquote, diabolic cruelty to add famine to the horrors of war. Bad enough as it is, that would make it worse. I like verse 19. What's this fruit tree? Is it a man that it should be besieged by you? A man can fight back, so you're going to have to kill him. He can come back to bite you. as he gets his as he joins the future army that will attack Israel, but a tree can't do that. So it's ridiculous to cut a tree down. So ladies and gentlemen, thus are the wars. Thus are the laws concerning the wars of Israel. Now in our next audio, we'll go to Deuteronomy chapter 21, the entire chapter. This is a chapter that has miscellaneous legal provisions for miscellaneous matters. For example, atonement for unsolved murders, marrying female slaves, what to do with rebellious sons, what to do about a man who's hanged for a crime, he's left out on a tree too long, that kind of thing. So for that legal potpourri, I hope you stay tuned for the next audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.